Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my honored guest is Steve Erickson. His new book is called Shadowban. It's a novel, and I thought it was so absorbing and so intense that I've read it three times. I was in equal parts in a state of adoration and also shattered by the book. Tell me, do you believe a novel should be an intense experience?
Well, first of all, Michael, thank you for having me on the show. I really appreciate it. I write my novels hoping that they read as if they were written in one stretch and as if they were going to be read in one stretch, which I realize they're not going to be. But nonetheless, I think that makes for a certain intensity. My hope, especially with a novel like this one, is to sweep the reader along over whatever, you know, speed bumps of comprehension the novel may present, and to have the reader caught up in the world that the novel's trying to create.
On the back cover of the book, Jonathan Lethem uses the words lucid dreaming. And I do feel like that the book has me wide awake while dreaming. It's an extraordinary experience. That dream really begins with an image, which is the premise on which the book rests. Tell us about that.
Well, one afternoon in the not-too-distant future, the Twin Towers suddenly reappear in the Dakota Badlands. And as people from all over the country and then all over the world begin to gather to see the towers, the reader begins to understand that up on one of the top floors of one of the towers is living Jesse Presley, who is the stillborn twin of Elvis. And as he is trying to find his way out of the tower, he's going mad from a voice in his head that is his but isn't, and from a memory of an America where he existed in his brother's place.
Yes, it's a parallel America. There's been a Jesse Presley, but no Elvis Presley. People have never heard one for the money, two for the show, three to get ready. But in this book, that inferior Elvis, he doesn't have a voice. He's very handsome.
Right.
And he ends up being a male model type who hangs around Warhol's factory.
Right. Even though Jesse has replaced Elvis, he's haunted by Elvis. He is haunted by what he knows that Elvis would have become. Now and then he will run into people in his America who also know that he's the wrong one, that America got him instead of the one it should have gotten. And I think this creates kind of breaches in American reality through which he and others and we get glimpses of the America we missed.
And we discover that the title, Shadowban, which is a road, but it's also Jesse. He's shadow born. Mm-hmm. He's the shadow of the missing Elvis.
Right.
And America never gets to hear the Beatles because they were inspired by Elvis Presley, and we watch a John Lennon-esque character become first the proprietor of a used record shop and then slowly but surely a homeless person,
right.
A lost person. In other words, in this book, we imagine an America that is not our dream of America, that doesn't conform to the American dream. And it struck me that at this moment, who isn't thinking about alternative Americas? What if the America we're stepping into is so different from the America we know that we have to dream it up all over again?
Yeah. And as well, I think, you know, the archaeology of that American dream is found in its music. And Elvis, or the missing Elvis, is sort of a stand-in for that. But we, you know, we are reminded again and again in the novel that Black Americans in particular, the descendants of slaves, invented for all intents and purposes 20th century Western music, and that represents this American idea to so much of the world.
And since there's no Elvis to crib from that music doesn't enter the mainstream. It stays on the level of, well, the exalted level of church music,
right,
and music exemplary of blues and spiritual suffering. But in terms of that knowledge that we have of the others among us, their music, their sound, their dream, their song, that would have been left out as well. And it's a mixed blessing, because there's a character rather like Malcolm X, mm-hmm, in this novel who says, well, no, Elvis just stole from us.
That's right.
It's not the best thing in the world. We were ripped off.
Right. When people begin to gather at the towers, they're all hearing music come from the towers, and they're all hearing different music come from the towers.
It's amazing. Some of them are there, and they don't see the towers. Others see them. Others see them, but they're silent. Still others see them, but there's music. And still others hear different songs.
Right.
The music is, well, I hate to use the phrase, ambient.
Right.
It's right. Not coming from anywhere. It's the aura of the towers. No one's playing it. Although Jesse is upstairs, he's caught inside the music.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, one of the characters who is a young man driving across the country with his black sister, muses at some point that the towers are almost like two giant stereo speakers. One is the base of the American idea, and one is the treble.
Oh, that's marvelous. First, the towers appear. But then a number of other manifestations occur.
Right.
Describe.
You know, it's a kaleidoscopic novel. It takes on the effect of a montage at some point. It's a quite entropic novel before things finally come together at the end. I wasn't setting out to write a novel about Elvis Presley, that's for sure. It was a novel about America, and it was a novel, it was a novel that I reconsidered the American idea, and that, as you say, you know, finds the country at the edge of its own imagination, trying to reconceive the American idea. That, I think, became more and more the impetus for the book as I was writing. I didn't start out knowing all that, because I never do when I start writing. I had this image. I can still remember the night it came to me. It kind of was a bolt from the blue. One of the first questions I pondered, not for very long, because I figured out the answer, was whether there should be somebody in the other tower. And then I realized that the point of that tower was its emptiness. And as I wrote the book over the course of 2 years, I was sort of taking my own road trip, if you will.
Yes, it is a road novel. It's Shadowban by my guest, Steve Erickson. But it's not a road novel. It's a shadow road novel. Mm-hmm. It's a trip through a phantom America with a highway that frequently is alluded to that appears when you fall asleep at the wheel. Mm-hmm. Well, one of the bigger feeling explosions in the book, we meet John F. Kennedy. But it's a Kennedy who is in his wheelchair full time, living sort of like FDR lived, hiding the fact that he was crippled mm-hmm. when he was our president. Mm-hmm. Now he lives in a wheelchair with his crutches, with his back destroyed, and he's just a kind of saddened mm-hmm. sort of playboy type who hangs around Warhol's factory looking at the girls.
Well, he's a Kennedy who, in fact, never becomes president.
Yes.
So he never fulfills that destiny. And in part, that's because I think Kennedy was very much a zeitgeist president. If you go back and try to figure out how Kennedy won the nomination, first of all, because it's easier to understand how he won the election, but how he won the nomination, it was something in the air. He had no great record in the Senate. He was not a particularly vivid spokesman on the side of any compelling issue the way that Lincoln was on the side of slavery or the way Obama was on the side of the Iraq War. So how did Kennedy get there? And he got there because the times were ready for him. But what if they were different times than the times we knew? What if the American times of the second half of the 20th century were different from the American century that we knew?
Are there other people on the Shadowban?
That's a great question, and it stands with the other question of whether the Shadowban actually exists, or whether there's a different Shadowban for each person who drives it. These siblings that are traveling across the country, you know, they keep hearing about the Shadowban as a rumor, as a secret, as the country's secret. It's not drawn on any map. There's no GPS that's going to direct them there.
They are Parker and his adopted sister, Zima.
That's correct.
And there's a suggestion that something has already happened
right.
to America. There's something sometimes referred to as a rupture,
right.
sometimes referred to as disunion.
Right.
And they are going to visit their mother in Michigan.
Right.
There's a suggestion that she's moved away from them,
right.
that their father is either missing or dead.
Right.
And here is where one of the major themes of the book enters. What is the inheritance that parents leave their children?
Mm-hmm.
In this case, for Parker and Zima, it's a playlist for a mixtape
right.
that the father has left them of his favorite songs, American songs for the most part, going from the 20s
mm-hmm.
to the present.
Mm-hmm.
they've been left a notebook with comments on the songs.
Right.
When they were young, he played these things for them, but what young people want to hear their parents' songs?
Exactly.
And now they're hearing it not as annoyance, but as inheritance.
Right.
And they're hearing...
That's a great way to put it.
Billie Holiday. Mm-hmm. They're hearing, Bruce Springsteen. They're hearing a song that Dylan didn't release, but was on his, what were they called, basement tapes?
Right, right.
Another case of something rejected and hidden coming back to the fore.
Right. They're hearing everything from Louis Armstrong to MIA and the White Stripes. And as they're driving across the country without giving too much of the book away, the music around them is disappearing. And it's all coming out of the speakers of their car. And they become kind of notorious road warriors of music as they drive, and the radio stations are following them. And
just as hundreds of thousands, millions of people gather to see the Phantom Twin Towers, they're a car whose directions are being reported. People who need to hear music crowd around, wanting to hear the songs from the crack in the windows.
Right, right.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Steve Erickson about his book, Shadowbound. We'll continue after this short break. Michael Silverblatt here. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Steve Erickson about his new book, Shadowbound, a reexamination of American identity through some of its staples, road trips, an ever-shifting history, and groundbreaking music. Since you were writing about so many both highly imaginary and events that are presented ambivalently happening to some people, eluding others, was the writing particularly difficult to accomplish?
It was, I'll say, unique in terms of the writing. I usually start out with a pretty strong notion of what the work is. I have a pretty fair idea where it's going. I don't like to figure out everything because I want to leave open the possibility of accidents that aren't accidents. And this novel, has got a fractured quality that I exacerbated for a while before, at the end, feeling like I needed to put a few of the pieces back together so that people would be able to see the whole.
Well, it seems to me that this novel was written practically a page at a time. That, we're dealing on each page with usually two paragraphs.
Right.
That are there to represent the twin towers and all the other twin ships, and that because of this, the pages are short.
Right.
You hurtle through them, and before you know it, you're in a dreamscape in which all kinds of unexpected things are happening. In fact, by the last 30 pages of the book, I became aware that part of my thrill, even the third time round, was of not quite knowing what would happen next.
Mm-hmm.
And that this is the condition that we're living in America. It's
right.
A new America. We once knew what our goals were and where we were going.
Right. And in the same way that I kept sort of reimagining the novel, which is to say every 75 pages, it almost becomes a new novel altogether before it becomes one whole novel at the end. I think that we keep reimagining the country every 75 years or so, hoping that at the end there's going to be a whole country. There's going to be there's going to be a cohesive nation.
Do you have a section that you can read for us?
Yes. The question that I've asked a lot over the last 3 months is whether, you know, whether this book matters right now with what's going on. And I'm not the person to answer that. But I think that if it matters at all to anyone, the reason comes pretty early in the novel. There's and that's on page 2, where we meet a truck driver named Aaron, who will be the first person to see the towers. And he has on his back bumper a sticker that says, "Save America from itself." And he realizes he doesn't quite know what that means. And on the lives of my children, Michael, the better part of me, when I wrote that scene 3 years ago, which is to say not the craven, ambitious, egomaniacal novelist part, would have hoped that that scene would be less relevant now instead of more. What that bumper sticker means is we're in this 230-year loop, I think, of self-betrayal and self-redemption. And America goes through betrayal and redemption over and over. We broke the American promise the moment we made it, when we kicked the can of slavery 75 years down the road. And that caught up with us, and we had to deal with it. And the dark realization that sort of drove the writing of this novel wasn't that it's not a unified country or that it's a divided country, because that's not a revelation at all. I think we all know that. There's no reconciling these two halves. You can't reconcile the America that elects the first African American president with an America that would vote for somebody endorsed by the Ku Klux Klan. And we've got to choose.
Steve Erickson reading a section from Shadowban.
In what by this point is a growing tradition of political uselessness, some lay plans to greet the next tower's manifestation in yet another 20 years, although precisely what plan is to be laid remains unclear. Will a massive net be dropped from the sky to hold the towers in place once they return? Will the skyscrapers be tasered into acquiescence with an immense surge of electricity? In the meantime, America, the America that is to say that never looked like anything but what it ever was, a dream, comes to bear less resemblance to itself until it eludes all recognition. Regions secede from the nation, states from regions, cities from states. By mid-century, the recently formed Arklahoma Christian conglomerate applies to the World Trade Organization for a patent on, quote-unquote, America. A rage of countersuits are filed. Attempting without satisfaction to assess the petitions by typical standards of singularity, functionality, or precedent, the organization's council ultimately gathers representatives for the various claimants in a locked conference room where each has posed a question with the understanding that the patent for America legitimately belongs to whichever answers correctly. Who recorded West End Blues in June 1928? The country itself becomes crisscrossed by so-called shadow highways that remain the only geography recognized as federal land still subject to national sovereignty. 15,000 miles of such thoroughfares are marked by countless arched bridges constructed by squatters, desperate to live on or over whatever part of the landscape can still be called America. Sometimes these cults build overnight cities on the highways themselves, risking collision and vehicular slaughter for the privilege of assuming the mystical self-identification American. Although the cultists are viewed by most with suspicion, nonetheless, other continental occupants gather at the sides of the highways to listen to the music that comes from these makeshift cities. In the dark of night, in any spot of the Lake Country that blasts out all its horizons, the arches of America can be heard in either direction as a series of chiming rings stretching as far as the ear can listen.
Beautiful. I want to prevent listeners from going away confused and unhappy. That was King Oliver, right?
Yes, it was King Oliver, and it was also Louis Armstrong. There were actually two recordings.
Two recordings. And even eventually a recording of the West End Blues with vocals by Ethel Waters.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Absolutely spectacular. I've been talking with Steve Erickson, author of Shadowban, published by Blue Rider Press. Thank you, Steve, for joining me.
Michael, as ever, thank you.
It's a very timely book. I think it will be a book that joins the national conversation. You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Shadowban at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
A bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Rachel Kosk is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.